Welcome to From Silence to Self-Respect, The Deep Dive. This is a very personal story, and today we will be going through Chapter 1, The Four of Us.
We will be unpacking the core ideas.
Exactly. And today, we're diving into my memoir, From Silence to Self-Respect. I'm Larry Pfaff, the author. Today I have Laura with me, and she'll be helping with this particular exploration. Laura, welcome.
Thank you, Larry. I'm here to unpack some of the underlying themes. Let's dig in. So the book, it's about childhood trauma, survival, identity, addiction, and that long road to healing, a complex journey.
It really is. Our focus today is on one chapter called The Four of Us. It looks at how a specific kind of unpredictable environment shaped me, made me hypervigilant.
That hypervigilance is key, isn't it? That constant state of high alert, always scanning?
Always scanning. It's exhausting. And you know, it started way before the book. I never ever expected an obituary to change my life, but it did.
An obituary? That's an unusual starting point.
Yeah, about a year before Senior actually passed away, I just started writing his obituary.
While he was still alive?
Yeah, and it wasn't about planning ahead or anything like that, not at all. It was raw, gut-wrenching, and honestly just full of anger. An anger I didn't even know was still there, you know? Decades of pain just poured out.
Confronting those feelings, especially in that format, it takes courage. That sounds incredibly intense.
It felt necessary somehow. So over that year, I kept going back to it, tweaking it.
Refining it.
Kind of. More like stripping away the anger, trying to get to the truth. Not like get even truth, but the kind that maybe sets you free.
A truth for yourself, primarily.
Right. So when Senior finally passed, I posted that version online and I braced myself. Yeah, completely expected backlash, judgment.
As it wasn't a typical sanitized remembrance.
Not at all. I thought people would say it was disrespectful, you know, that I'd gone too far.
But that's not what happened.
No, the opposite, actually. It went viral within days. Thousands of people reached out, so many saying they grew up in homes just like mine, thanking me for saying what they couldn't.
Wow. That must have been overwhelming, but validating too.
Hugely validating. There was one line that really hit home for people. It got shared over and over. Lawrence Sr. can be remembered for being a father to many and a dad to none.
That's powerful. It draws such a clear line between biological role and emotional presence.
Yeah, it captures that specific kind of void, I think. Presence without connection.
Something many people unfortunately recognize.
Exactly. People said it made them feel less alone. And honestly, that's when the idea for the book really started.
Realizing your story had resonance?
Yeah, for so long I never believed my voice mattered, that I mattered. Writing that, seeing the response, it helped me finally grasp, like deep down, that my needs aren't too much.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't have to earn love by performing or pleasing. I can just be, exist as I am.
That's a profound shift, moving from external validation to internal worth. Articulating truth can be incredibly healing, not just personally, but for building connection.
Definitely. So, to really get why that obituary came out the way it did, why it struck such a chord, I realized I had to go back, way back, to the beginning, to the very beginning, before I even had words for the hard stuff. It started when I was 6 months old. We moved from Queens to Centereach.
That's a big change, even for an infant.
Huge. I don't remember it, obviously, but the family stories, they paint this picture of a really sharp pain.
Because environments shape us from day one, right? Even before verbal memory, we're soaking it all in. Sensory input, emotional tone.
Absolutely. Hmm. In Queens, we lived with my mom's parents, and their house, it was just alive.
How so?
Constant noise, but good noise. My grandmother always cooking, pots banging, the radio on. Voices overlapping, my grandfather's laugh just booming through the house.
Sounds like a warm chaos.
It was chaotic, yeah. But warm, connected, predictable in its way. You felt held by it.
Psychologically, that sounds like a secure base.
Mm-hmm.
Consistent warmth, responsiveness, foundational stuff.
Centereach? Nothing like it. The house looked normal enough. 4 bedrooms, bath and a half, blue siding, square lawn.
Standard suburban starter home.
Right, but inside, the quiet was different. It was sharp. Suddenly, it was just, well, the four of us.
The four of you?
Yes. My mother, Senior, me, and the bottle, alcohol. It was always there, within Senior's reach. It became like the third parent in the house.
Wow, personifying it like that as a third parent? That really paints a picture of its influence.
It controlled everything. Even in silence, it was there, lurking. The mood could shift with one sip, one drink, and the whole room could ignite.
And addiction does that. It warps the family system. It becomes this volatile force controlling the emotional climate.
When I was just over 2 years old, my sisters arrived. I felt it. I didn't understand it or have words, but the house, it would just tense up when Senior walked in.
You could sense the shift?
Oh, yeah. Everyone could feel it. Just knowing Senior was coming changed the atmosphere before his arrival.
That's amazing that at 2 years old, you were incredibly tuned in to that nonverbal stuff. Body language, tone, energy shifts. You must have been absorbing it all, building these internal maps of safety and danger.
Right. That's where the hypervigilance starts wiring in, I think. You learn to watch everything.
Constantly scanning.
There's this one memory. When Senior worked shift work, the whole house went quiet. He'd come home in the morning, stomp up the stairs, and collapse into bed like he was owed silence. We weren't allowed to breathe too loud, let alone talk or move. If we made a sound, my mother would get on us, snap her fingers or hush us, her eyes wide, warning us. If she wasn't fast enough, it was too late. We'd hear the thud of Senior's feet above us, then his bedroom door. He stomped down the stairs. Then his voice, booming and angry. Whatever he said, it was meant to blame us for ruining his sleep. He didn't care what was going on. He just exploded.
Oh, wow.
That's such a vivid image. The dump, dump, dump. The thudding footsteps becoming cues.
Signals.
Signals that even playtime noise, innocent noise, could be wrong. Dangerous somehow.
Don't draw attention.
That message got in deep, fast.
It's powerful conditioning. Learning that quiet equals safety. Stillness equals safety. It erases any idea of how to be a child. Except when Senior was shouting, no one ever said be quiet or be still.
Mm.
But I learned fast it was safer to be invisible than to be wrong.
The unspoken rules.
Yeah, I can barely remember the rug or wall colors from back then. But I remember the tension, like the air was thick with it. Senior set the rhythm, and we all just revolved around him. That constant low-level threat. It requires constant scanning, interpreting subtle cues, and you feel perpetually on edge. Always on edge. And you learn to make yourself small. The rules sunk in. Children should be seen, not heard. Don't ask for anything unless you're sure you'll get it.
Self-minimization becomes a survival strategy.
Senior didn't talk much, not to us children, but his presence. He could shut things down with just a look, a shift in his body, and the alcohol was always there in his hand or at his side.
A quiet constant.
Yeah. Later, my mother called his drinking a disease, but back then, that wasn't easy to comprehend.
You just knew its effects.
I just knew some nights he'd sort of fade away in his chair, unreachable. Other nights, the drink pulled him somewhere darker, more volatile.
And you learned to read the signs?
Had to. The sound of his footsteps coming home, the way the door closed behind him, the kind of silence that followed. You learned to sense which version of him was walking in.
That's an incredible amount of emotional calculation for a child.
It is, but I never realized that until I started writing the book. Right after I turned 2 and my twin sisters were born, that wiring, it was set, done. I knew how to stay small, hold my breath, disappear if needed.
Safer to be invisible than wrong.
Absolutely. Safer than making a mistake. Safer than drawing attention.
And that hypervigilance, that way of reading the room through tiny cues?
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel different as an adult compared to just being, say, an observant person?
Oh, it's the constancy. Observant people notice things. Hypervigilant people feel like they have to notice everything all the time because danger might be lurking even when it isn't.
It's an internal alarm that's always on.
Always on. And it's exhausting.
Yeah.
Now here's the part that's tough to talk about even now. The story behind the story.
What you didn't put in the book.
Yeah, things I left out. The writing of the obituary that kicked things off, but revisiting those early years. Like the full depth of that initial anger.
You started chipping it away.
I did. But feeling it initially, it was intense, almost volcanic. And the emotional toll of really going back, putting those decades of pain onto paper, I couldn't fully convey that in the book.
You need to shape it, make it constructive for the reader, not just a raw outpouring.
Right. I wanted it to be a guide, maybe. Show a path forward, not just scream into the void, but writing this chapter, the four of us, that was something else.
What was the hardest part of writing that specific chapter?
It wasn't just remembering the facts. It was the feeling reconstructing those moments, the sharp quiet, the tension, reliving those emotions, remembering the impending doom when Senior entered a room.
The physicality of the memory.
Yes. What I couldn't fully say then, what I maybe still struggle to articulate, is how physical that anger and fear felt when I dredged it all up. It wasn't just sadness, it was this burning resentment. And sitting with that child version of me, reliving that quiet terror, the emotional cost was huge, way more than I expected. It's one thing to remember, it's another to build it again with words and feel every edge.
It sounds almost like re-experiencing the trauma, even in the service of healing, which raises a question. For people listening who might be reflecting on their own past, what's the value in digging into those painful details if it costs so much?
If you're not writing a book, that's a really important question. For me, and I think for anyone, it's about acknowledging the truth. Not just knowing it in your head, but feeling it. Understanding how deep those patterns run.
Giving voice to the experience.
Giving voice to the child who couldn't speak, then it's the one who had to be invisible. It's painful, yeah, an excavation. But it feels essential for building something new, for self-respect, for understanding why you are the way you are.
To truly heal the foundation, you have to understand how it was built.
Exactly. And maybe that leads to the question I want to leave you with today, something you might carry in your own life. Have you ever grieved someone who wasn't even dead yet?
A powerful question about complex loss.
It really gets to the core of things, doesn't it? Relationships, emotions, how we navigate it all. So thank you for joining me on this deep dive.
Thank you.
Next time, we'll shift gears a bit. I'll talk about a surprising moment in the next chapter, the moment I realized about my promotion, and how strangely it tied right back into everything we discussed today. If you grew up walking on eggshells, if you learned to be quiet instead of safe, you're not alone. Connecting those early patterns to breakthroughs. What happened to you wasn't your fault, but healing, that's yours to claim. If any of this hits too close, take care of yourself. Step away if you need to, or talk to someone. There are real resources out there, places that understand trauma that starts early and runs deep. The National Child Traumatic Stress Network, NCTSN.org, Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families, adultchildren.org. The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, not just a book, but a survival map. Therapy, especially trauma-informed therapy, you deserve it, even if no one ever said so. Thanks for listening. Take a breath. We'll talk more next time.